It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, buttons have a lot of power, from turning on heavy machinery to easily snagging you a vending machine snack. We talk about the history and influence of all kinds of buttons since the 1800s and find out why they were often controversial. First, our next guest says the problem with welfare programs is that they encourage people to not work, but he's got an idea that he says rewards gainful employment while still being compassionate. It's called universal basic income. Essentially, you get a check from the government each month, but no other public assistance benefits, so you have to get a job in most cases in order to earn enough money to make ends meet. Our guest makes the case that Wisconsin should try this out on a limited scale as an experiment. Mike McCabe is the founder of Blue Jean Nation and former executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, before we get to the idea of the universal basic income, which has been tried in some places around the world, what do you see as wrong with public assistance as it exists today?
Well, the welfare programs that we've had for a very long time and we spend a great deal of money on do have a disincentive to work. You have to be poor to get the help, and then you have to stay poor to keep the help. And there are always going to be these eligibility thresholds that are established. And so if you're working, you inevitably come to a moment when earning one more dollar will lose you far more than that. Earning that extra dollar will make you ineligible for the assistance. You lose it. So you're actually better off if you cut back on your hours. You're better off not working. And you know, the idea of universal basic income takes away that disincentive. It rewards work and basically says you can climb the ladder and then just keep right on climbing. You don't have that disincentive to work. And so it's a way to sort of move away from or move beyond welfare as we've known it, encourage work, but also address the reality that we're now going through deindustrialization in this country, and an awful lot of workers are watching their employment automated out of existence, and that's creating enormous stress, and of course that's one of the big factors behind America's growing mental health crisis.
So in a recent piece you wrote in the Capital Times, you say, let's experiment. What do you want to try?
Well, I don't think we should bite off more than we can chew. So we can start small with a very small scale experiment in Wisconsin just to see how this works. You know, Wisconsin has had a reputation as a policy pioneer. When we went through the Industrial Revolution and people left the land and moved to cities to work in factories, that of course prompted a response to deal with the trauma that came with that Industrial Revolution, and Wisconsin led the way. Wisconsin was the first state to create unemployment compensation, workers' compensation for those injured in the workplace, the first state to create child labor laws. Social Security was invented here to create a financial stability for senior citizens. Wisconsin led the way, and you know, now that we're going through deindustrialization and robots are here and there are more on the way and driverless vehicles are coming and there's going to be millions of people who drive for a living who are going to watch that employment disappear, we need to start thinking now about how we respond to this new economy that's emerging. And so what I've suggested is start small, just a very small-scale experiment, maybe 1,000 participants. And if the basic income is $1,000 a month, we're talking $12 million a year. And in a state budget that's close to $80 billion, that is a tiny drop in the bucket, very easy to finance, doesn't require tax increases. And then we can see what happens. Do people continue to work? Do they work more? Are they maybe leaving dead-end jobs and deciding to pursue a dream to start a new business or to take a risk and that could really benefit the economy and many other workers by doing so? What's the effect of it? And then if it really has a beneficial effect, you can look at expanding it. If it doesn't have the desired effect or actually backfires, then you go no further. And you know, it's a very low risk, extremely affordable kind of experiment that could give us some insight about how we might respond to the deindustrialization that we're going through and the effects that that has and the stress that that produces for so many workers who used to work in factories but have watched their jobs give way to robots or those many people driving who perhaps won't have employment once the driverless vehicles are upon us. It's a way to respond to all of these changes in our economy.
We're talking to Mike McCabe, founder of Blue Jean Nation, about his idea. He says we should experiment with the idea of universal basic income here in Wisconsin with a small-scale starter project. And Mike, to clarify, these 1,000 people, or however many it ends up being, they would get this $1,000 a month. They would get it if they work a minimum wage job, if they make $100,000 a year or more. Their actual income doesn't matter, right?
Correct. And, you know, I think one of the benefits to having the program be universal is that it removes the stigma that comes with receiving welfare payments, for example. And that's been a driving force behind division and animosity toward low-income people in our society there's a stigma attached to receiving those benefits. Not only is there a disincentive to work because you have to be poor to get the help and stay poor to keep the help, but then there's this stigma that gets attached to receiving that money, and you end up being looked down upon or even attacked by others in society. This steers clear of that. And one of the things that it would do is if all you can find out there is low-wage work, it allows you to do that work without falling into poverty. We've got so many people who are in the ranks of the working poor who go to work every day. They're working sometimes 2 and 3 jobs, and yet they can't get themselves above the poverty line because the work they find pays such dismal wages. So this creates an economic foundation that they can stand on, a platform that they can stand on, start climbing the ladder, and then they can just keep on climbing. They never reach that point where there's suddenly a disincentive to work, where they have to cut back their hours or risk losing help.
Now let's talk about the people at the bottom end of the economic spectrum and how this would work. Would they then no longer get, I don't know, food aid, health care assistance from the government, child care assistance? Is everything else off the table?
That's what the experiment should be about. And one of the things there certainly should be part of the test group should be people who would get that basic income and then would be free to go out there and work and earn as much as they can. But they wouldn't be eligible for other forms of public assistance. You could design the test so that some people would at least perhaps be eligible for some help with health care or other things. But that's exactly why a small-scale experiment makes sense, is that you could begin to test this kind of thing to see how effective could this be at moving us beyond welfare as we've known it. How effective would it be at encouraging work? How effective would it be at helping people be more attentive to family or to take risks at perhaps bettering themselves by acting on that dream that they've always had, the idea that they've had for starting a new business, but they never felt like they were financially in a position to pursue that dream because they were just trying to keep food on the table and a roof over their heads? Would this end up liberating people in a way that could actually stimulate the economy and make us all better off? You know, that's exactly the kind of thing that we need to explore. What we've had is an awful lot of years with the system as we currently have it, but our economy is changing so radically. And so many people are watching good employment, good paying, family supporting jobs automated out of existence. And what they're left with is they're going out there trying to find, you know, service sector jobs that pay sub living wages, and they're trying to make ends meet, and they're struggling to like crazy. And of course, that produces stress and we end up with a mental health epidemic on our hands. We've got to think creatively about how to respond to these changes in our economy. I'd like to see Wisconsin lead the way in this country. There's been no state in America that's had such a statewide experiment. I'd love to see Wisconsin become the first.
We're talking about our guest call to experiment with the idea of a universal income program in Wisconsin. Mike McCabe is the founder of Blue Jean Nation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? How do you think about what do you think about giving people $1,000 a month? This would be regardless of their income, but replacing most, maybe all, other forms of public assistance with that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're talking about the idea of a universal income as a possible replacement for public assistance programs. Mike McCabe is with us, founder of Blue Jean Nation. He wrote an opinion piece about this, proposing an experiment, a limited experiment with this here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? What questions do you have for our guest about how this might work and the benefits and possible complications of it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to our callers. Ted is with us in Gordon. Ted, hi.
Hi. My first question is, since you are proposing $1,000 a month to maybe 1,000 people, regardless of income, that'll bring down the number you're actually setting to those closer to poverty or on welfare, clearly a couple hundred or so. Is that enough to come to any conclusions that are scientifically valid? And is there a control group to compare what happens to people without the stipend of $1,000 a month?
Thanks for the call, Ted. So a small portion of this 1,000 might be those people who are currently receiving public assistance. Mike, can we really learn that much?
Well, you can design the experiment any way you want, and you can make more of the people who are part of the experiment, people who have received public assistance or who are low income people who perhaps are in low wage employment right now. All I'm trying to do is try to start the conversation and get people thinking about whether it's worthwhile to pursue such an experiment. If lawmakers decided that this was something that they were willing to explore, then you know, people could be brought in to design the experiment. You know, it certainly wouldn't be something that I would expect to design single-handedly. This is something that a lot of people would need to be involved in, and it can be set up in any way you like. There was a time in Wisconsin, or there was a time in America, where there was no Social Security for senior citizens, where there was no unemployment compensation for those who became jobless, or no workers' compensation for those who were injured in the workplace. And when those programs were first imagined, there were a lot of people who said, well, how the heck would that work? But we worked through those questions, and those policies were developed, and of course, they've become fixtures in the American economy and in American life. And they were responses to the last time that we went through what amounts to an economic revolution, the Industrial Revolution. Well, we're going through another economic revolution now, and it is all about robotics and artificial intelligence and automation, and that is going to significantly affect not only the American economy but working people in this country. We need to at least think creatively about how we might respond to that. And I think what makes sense is to start now, so that we can design experiments that will help us understand how this policy would work and what effects it would have on people, and whether it would be worthwhile to pursue on a broader scale, rather than wait until all of the people, the millions of Americans who drive for a living, have been replaced by driverless vehicles, and all the factory workers have pretty much been replaced by robots, and wait until we've got people who are really facing economic trauma before we begin to act.
Let's go back to our calls. Thanks for calling in, Ted. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hello.
Hi. The idea, I love the UBI. I've been telling people about it for years. I love it, but you cannot take away benefits from poor people and replace it with the UBI, because the UBI is going to go to you no matter what you do, how much you make. So if you don't penalize rich people, you cannot go penalizing the poor people. So you have to work out those social things differently. But that UBI has to just go, and so if that poor person is getting $600 a month now, you have to throw that $1,000 on top of the $600. You can't take the $600 away because you're not taking money away from wealthier people.
Chris, thanks for the call. So Mike, she says people at the lower end take a hit before they get the benefit. People at the top just get the benefit in this change.
Well, yeah, obviously, if you implemented a system like this on at full scale, the cost would be significant, and I think the cost would be paid for with a progressive tax, expecting those who are wealthiest or who have the greatest ability to pay to pay more. So there could very well be that cost to the richest in our society. And I really think that that a small-scale experiment should explore these very questions. What would happen if you provided this sort of basic income with no eligibility threshold, so that as people worked and continued to work, they would never reach that point where they would have to cut back on their hours to keep the assistance? What would happen there? Would it be possible to be a replacement? And you know, would people end up being better off, or would they be no better off or worse off? And what, depending on what that test run showed, that would be what you base a decision to expand the program on. You don't go any further unless this looks like it has the ability to be really beneficial. But I tell you, when you look at most people out there who don't have a high level of education or have watched factory jobs automated out of existence, for example, a lot of them are just trying to make ends meet by working low-wage jobs, and sometimes two or three of them, and yet they still can't keep themselves above poverty. What would happen there if they had $1,000 a month to start with and then had the low-wage job or two, and they could build on that? I think they would be so much better off. Well, that's exactly what we would want to find out. Would this be something that would truly boost people who are currently very economically vulnerable? If it would, and it would create more economic stability and financial security for very vulnerable workers as we go through deindustrialization, then this could be something that would be a real policy innovation along the lines of those innovations that we saw Wisconsin make when we were going through the Industrial Revolution, from unemployment compensation and workers' compensation all the way to Social Security for seniors.
We're talking to Mike McCabe. He says Wisconsin should try an experiment with universal income. Let's go back to our callers. Diane is with us in Barron. Diane, hello.
Yeah, hi. I had already given my statement. This is the first time I called in. I didn't realize that you go on the air later. In any case, I'm very opposed to this proposal in that, one, you start with a small group, great, it's not going to cost much, but if it expanded, it's you know, potentially a huge amount of money, you know, that taxpayers are, again, going to be responsible or liable for. And the working poor and these vulnerable workforce, you know, people, families are getting assistance or qualifying for assistance because they qualify. They're in the poverty level. I know so many people, individuals and families, that work 40 hours a week plus and still qualify for help because our employers are not paying a living wage. And until we fix that, the robotics and all this, you know, talk about our jobs being replaced with...
I'm going to jump in, Diane, because we don't have too much time left. Mike, she says, no, let's have a living wage for people working those low-wage jobs.
Oh, I absolutely agree that there needs to be a living wage established. And And I, you know, it's been a long time since the minimum wage was increased to really keep pace with the cost of living. So there's no question that that makes perfect sense. But again, we've established what's been described as a safety net for people. A whole patchwork of programs, and they cost a great deal of money, and it's all paid for by us taxpayers. But it does have in there a disincentive to work, because once you reach a certain threshold of income, you no longer are eligible. And so people do routinely get to that threshold and have to decide whether they cut back on their hours or whether they sort of go it alone and try to make it without that help. And you know, with so many people in a vulnerable position economically, it seems to me that we've got to at least think creatively about how to better use our resources to address those needs, to try to remove the stigma of public assistance, to try to remove disincentives to work.
Mike, I want to jump in our last minute to run this by you. James on Facebook writes, "It's an idea with merit, but ultimately it's not compatible with American culture yet." In our last 40 seconds or so, Mike, what do you say?
Well, I think probably there were people who said the very same thing when Social Security was developed, that was not in keeping with American culture and workers' compensation and unemployment compensation. But when conditions reached a point where the elderly were the poorest segment of the American population, Social Security was enacted and has become a real American institution. And these other kinds of responses to the Industrial Revolution also became really embedded in American life. And America has to continue to evolve, and we have to change with the times. We have to address changing conditions. We are going through an economic revolution right now. We've got to think creatively about how to deal with it.
Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Mike McCabe, founder of Blue Jean Nation. We talked with him about his call for making Wisconsin a testing ground, an experiment for universal basic income. Coming up after the news, buttons. We use them every day, from the elevator to the like button online. Our guest shares the history of pushing buttons and how they've influenced our society for over 100 years. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a group of lawmakers say they've reached a tentative deal on funding for border security that could avert a federal government shutdown. We'll talk about the details and how President Trump has reacted. First, think about all of the buttons you might have pushed so far today. The button to start your coffee maker, buttons to cross the street, call an elevator, turn on the TV, the like button on social media, and more. Our next guest says buttons look simple, but they have a complicated history, and they tell a story about labor and gender and power relations in our culture. Rachel Plotnick is an assistant professor of cinema and media studies in the Media School at Indiana University Bloomington. Her new book is called Power Button: A History of Pleasure, Panic, and the Politics of Pushing. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I think probably a lot of us could have gone our whole lives pushing buttons and not really stopping to think about them. What caught your eye? Why did you stop and look at this daily fact of our lives?
Yeah, I think it was just really the ubiquity of this technology. As I began to look around, I was just astounded by how much I push buttons in my own daily life, watching my children pushing buttons, and everything from those physical buttons we push in our kitchens and on our garage door openers to our social media. It just seemed like one of this sort of taken for granted technologies that's really everywhere.
And in your book, you take us through the rise of buttons, mainly in the late 1800s. There's argument about what the first one might be, and that's okay. But while it seems automatic, we get what a button does, people had to be trained on what these were and what they did, right?
Yes, that was what was really interesting to me, was just to see all of the anxiety around button pushing, the uncertainty about what buttons would do to an early electrifying society. And one of the things that I really noticed is that people were just concerned broadly about electrification and industrialization and introducing machines into everyday life. And I think buttons offered this kind of safe face potentially that could make that electricity less, scary or intimidating.
Right. And that's something you write about, that the thing that the button might do might be really profound. It might make a big machine work. It could turn on a light. It could do a lot of different things. But that was all hidden. It was the mere touch of a button was the common phrase that was used to mask the complicated stuff going on behind the scenes.
Exactly. And I think even to this day, that's what makes buttons so attractive, is they operate on this kind of cause and effect system where you don't have to understand what's happening inside of the machine or behind the button. All you have to do is just push it. And then you get this kind of instant gratification or effect that's really pleasurable and gratifying. And so I think even back then, that was maybe even more intensified by the fact that people weren't used to seeing lights turn on or these different kinds of electrical mechanisms, you know, all of a sudden be spurred into motion.
And there was concern. You mentioned anxiety. Instead of using muscle and power to do things, we were just touching a button. Were people worried about what that meant, about whether we were actually doing work?
Absolutely. I think this was a primary theme that came up in my research, was this idea that, hey, we're sort of transferring all of our manual labor over to machines. And are we becoming a society that privileges effortless interaction too much? You know, do we want some things to be hard? For example, if you're going to take a life through the death penalty, should you have to actually work hard to take that life? Or should you just allow it to happen through this really easy mechanism of pushing a button? And so I think in many contexts, it became this concern over, do we really want to make everything in life so easy, so effortless? And should some things be a little bit more difficult than just pushing a button?
You talk about class and power dynamics with buttons. And one of the, you had a letter that somebody had written, I can't remember exactly. It's so difficult. I have to pull this bell, you know, and I have to go and maybe it doesn't work. And I have to really pull on it to call my servants or workers in to help me out. Isn't there a better way? This was a big part of why we ended up with buttons that rang bells.
Yes, you know, bells were one of the earliest uses of push buttons. And I think it was fascinating to see how people were complaining about having to use these hand crank bells or pull these levers. And so that was one of the first areas that you saw buttons really being employed, was to actuate bells in this way. And so there was a lot of discussion about how can we reduce the arm or even the whole hand just to that finger. And so I call that kind of the evolution of digital labor, which is only using our four fingers to kind of interact with all of these machines.
And that led to the rise of the character hated by workers, the push button boss.
Exactly. Yes, push button managers were really reviled, which I found so fascinating. You know, so many people complaining about usually the man who would sit behind a desk and just call his employees all day by pushing a button. Hey, come here for this. Hey, come here for that. And that's where you really saw that power imbalance between the manual laborer and the digital laborer, someone who just got to sit behind their desk and give out orders all day. People didn't like the feeling of being treated like servants.
Talking to Rachel Plotnick, author of the new book, Power Button, A History of Pleasure, Panic, and the Politics of Pushing. Rachel, from, I guess, the earliest vending machines to now Amazon buttons wherever we want them, you write that buttons have made it really easy for us to be consumers. Can you talk about how that evolved?
Yes, I think that was one of the primary ideas behind, you know, putting push buttons on so many technologies at the turn of the 20th century, was this idea that we can turn everyone into consumers by putting buttons on things. Because as we all know, it's really pleasurable to just push something and then get that thing that you want at the end, as we were talking about earlier. So you saw buttons crop up on things like consumer cameras, you know, the early Kodak cameras, to everything from vending machines and elevators, and as we talked about, bells. So I think in all these instances, there was this idea that we can convince consumers that electricity is good if we can also get them to push buttons and get those things that they're wanting.
And now Amazon has, I haven't experimented with these, you can put a button on your fridge, I guess, that says, you know, order whatever product from Amazon right now. And those have actually been outlawed in some countries. Is that right?
Yes, that's so fascinating. Yeah, so the Amazon Dash button, I think, has been an effort by the company to really sort of get across this idea that you can push a button and get anything that you want at any time. You know, you want toilet paper, just push that button. You're out of laundry detergent, just push that button. So it really takes this idea of push button consumerism, I think, to the extreme. And Germany has recently outlawed these buttons because of their lack of transparency, because consumers who push them don't necessarily know whether the price has changed on the product or really any information about what they're getting other rather than I just want to order that thing. And so I think this is a potential problem or downside with making everything sort of available at the push of a button is what kind of information are we giving consumers, and are they really able to make an educated choice when they push those buttons?
And earlier on in the button world than I would have expected, you write that we started using buttons as metaphors for our bodies, our psychology, in some cases, sexuality. Can you talk about how buttons became these metaphors in our daily lives?
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating. You know, of course, we probably all say, oh, so-and-so is pushing my buttons. You know, that's a really popular expression. And even in the late 19th century, people started thinking about what it meant to activate one's body by button or to turn someone on by button. And there definitely was a kind of sexual association with buttons as well. One of the interesting parts of my research found that doctors even, especially gynecologists, would talk about women's clitorises as electric buttons that you could push just to sort of turn them on. And they talked about this as very problematic, that we want to sort of reduce women's desire and therefore castrate them and turn off their electric buttons. So I think this was really an important kind of metaphor for thinking about control and how do we control different people's bodies in different ways and who gets access to that control. And so I think this metaphor of body and button has really continued to the present moment.
So what do we lose when we think of buttons as, I guess, just a source of convenience, making our lives easier? Again, at the mere touch of a button, we get whatever we want.
Yeah, for me, the main goal, and I think the idea behind my book, is to say, let's not just say either buttons are only good or only bad, because of course they're much more complicated than that. But how can we pay attention to many of the power dynamics that lurk behind them? Thinking about those questions of the push button manager or the consumer or someone working in a factory, you know, in all of these cases, there are the haves and the have nots, the people who get to push and the people who are then spurred to action by pushing. So I've really advocated for saying, let's look closer at the social dynamics that exist behind buttons rather than just paying attention to whether they're good or bad. And I think that also extends then to thinking about usability and how they work and people's daily experiences with buttons as well.
Now, a lot of the concerns you write about people having in the late 1800s, you know, what new technology would do, are our jobs becoming too easy, that sort of thing. Those same conversations are happening about new technologies today, literally today. Do you see a lot of similar themes from then till now?
There are remarkable parallels. I couldn't believe how many of the complaints, you know, in the 1900s were the same as what we're talking about right now. I think we worry about button mashers in video games, and we worry about people who are professionals losing their jobs to people who can just go ahead and push buttons, whether that's taking selfies or producing electronic music. So it's really everywhere still this question of, have we de-skilled our society? Does pushing a button make life too easy? So I don't think we've answered those kind of fundamental questions, even after all this time.
Digging into this history and looking at the story of buttons, do you find yourself hesitating before you push a button on an elevator, a phone, whatever?
I definitely think about it a lot more. You know, I think these are very seductive control mechanisms. They're very useful in daily life, but I can't hesitate but sort of pay attention to how buttons function in my universe and my ecosystem. And, you know, they are very, I think, much more salient and relevant to me than I ever would have noticed just a few years ago before studying these questions.
We'll leave it there for now. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Plotnick is an assistant professor of cinema and media studies at Indiana University. Her new book is called Power Button, A History of Pleasure, Panic, and the Politics of Pushing. Coming up, lawmakers have reached an agreement on funding for border security, but President Trump says he's not happy with it. We'll break down what the deal does and doesn't do. Stay with us. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democrats have introduced the Green New Deal, a series of non-binding proposals meant to combat climate change. We'll talk with Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan about his support for the resolution. Now, a group of lawmakers say they've reached a tentative deal on funding for border security. The news comes with just a few days before the government is set to shut down for the second time in less than a month. President Trump rallied in El Paso, Texas last night to ratchet up pressure for border wall funding. Eliza Collins is a congressional reporter for USA Today. Eliza, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I know this is a moving target, but what do we know about the details of this deal so far?
Well, the big thing everybody cares about probably is, did Trump get money for his wall? And he did. He got $1.375 billion for a structure along the southern border. there is no text of the deal yet, so we're basing this all off what we're hearing from aides and lawmakers. But it sounds like that money can be used for about 55 miles of structure. It's not going to be that concrete wall that Trump originally had asked for, but it would probably be something more like a steel fencing. So Democrats can claim it's a fence, the president can claim it's a wall, but it's a structure along the southern border. Another thing in there is detention beds. So ICE, Immigration Enforcement, basically has these beds in the interior of the country or also along the border where they hold either criminals or undocumented immigrants as they cross over. And Democrats had sought to limit that number. Republicans wanted money to be able to have as many beds as they said they needed. And it looks like there will be about 40,000 beds by the end of next year, which would be a decrease over what they currently have right now.
What kind of reactions are we hearing from key players in Congress to this deal that we don't know the details of so far?
Well, it really depends who you ask. The far right, which is a very influential wing with the president, Congressman Mark Meadows, the Freedom Caucus, they hate this deal. They basically say that this is Congress failing to do its job. It's not even coming close to what the president had asked for. But the truth is that group does not have a ton of power other than the president's ear. The people that really do have power right now are Senate and House leadership in both parties. They may not like this deal, but so far they've kind of loosely endorsed it with the caveat that they need to see final details. But their sense is they don't want another shutdown, and they think that this bipartisan compromise would keep them from another shutdown just as long as the president signs it.
And then there's the president. President Trump commented on the deal earlier this afternoon. Here's some of what he had to say.
I can't say I'm happy. I can't say I'm thrilled. But the wall's getting built. Regardless, doesn't matter, because we're doing other things beyond what we're talking about here. So we'll see what happens.
So is the president there hinting at this idea that's been out there for a while now of using, no matter what Congress passes, trying to use presidential emergency powers to find funding for more border wall construction?
Yeah, not exactly clear what he is hinting right there, because he also at one point made it seem like he could make changes to the bill, which is of course not true. The legislative branch is a completely different branch, but you hit the nail on the head with the idea of this. He could still accept what Congress has offered and still declare a national emergency. And that's something Senator Lindsey Graham, who is close to the president, was telling us about today on Capitol Hill. He was basically saying, you know, if the bill is as detailed, I think the president would probably support it, but that's so far from the $5.7 billion he had wanted for his wall. I'd also expect him to declare a national emergency and try to get money from other parts of the government in order to make up that difference between the almost $1.4 billion and the $5.7 billion.
And that is likely to be a legal headache, I guess, to say the least. There would be legal challenges to the president using that emergency power to try to pull funding from elsewhere. Department of Defense was one place that's been pointed toward. We would see this in courts probably, right?
Yes. Absolutely. Democrats have said that. They plan the minute that would happen, Democrats would take that to court, and it would likely be caught up in a very interesting legal battle. This is unprecedented. It's also really interesting because it divides Republicans. You mentioned the possibility of taking money from the Defense Department. I mean, Republicans do not like doing that. They generally support boosting funding for the Defense Department. The chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee today was telling us he's a Republican. He was saying he's tried to urge the president not to go that route. But the other concern Republicans have is sort of the precedent it would set. They don't like government overreach, and they say that if, you know, eventually a Democrat will be in the White House, and if Trump does this now, does that mean a Democrat could declare a, you know, climate change, a national emergency, or gun control? And that concerns Republicans as well. So not only will this be a legal challenge, I'd expect that this would split the Republicans as well.
Eliza Collins is with us, congressional reporter for USA Today, looking at a tentative deal anyway to avoid a shutdown that would start this weekend. Eliza, a lot of people are looking towards some influential conservative political commentators that seem to have President Trump's ear. Have we seen reaction from them to this deal?
We have, and they don't like it. We saw, you know, Ann Coulter, who was once a strong Trump ally, basically going after him today. We've seen Sean Hannity, you know, Trump's friend and influential Fox News host, calling this a garbage deal. And again, this goes with congressmen such as Mark Meadows, who also have the president's ear, saying they really do not like this. And this is a group that was able to get him to stop a shutdown, to launch a shutdown in December. It looked like he was maybe going to sign legislation to keep the government open on a short term. And Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, another conservative congressman, went to the White House and helped convince him, along with some of his friends in the conservative world, to go forward with the shutdown over the wall. This is an issue they feel the base feels very strongly about and would not forgive the president if he didn't go to the mat on this. So we'll have to see if him supporting this bill would be enough for the base, or if he's going to feel like he has to go the national emergency route, which is in a whole nother complicated route.
Right. President Trump said prior to the previous shutdown, he would take responsibility for the shutdown. Border security was that important. Speaking yesterday in El Paso, he said the shutdown was worth it because of the attention it drew to border issues. All that said, has President Trump expressed a willingness and interest in having another shutdown over border wall funding?
Well, he's really gone back and forth on this. What he has done now is said that if the government shuts down, it would be the Democrats' fault. He said that as recently as today. I'm not sure he can argue that if there is a bipartisan compromise in the House and Senate, and if it's able to pass through Congress and he decides to veto it. Like before, it would be him taking responsibility. We did see the president took responsibility before the last shutdown, and then, you know, Republicans did try to spin it as Democrats not working with him on it, which they were not willing to give him wall money. But polling showed that the public did blame the president. So he saw that polling. He ended up deciding that to end the shutdown, he would be willing to sign a temporary bill that didn't include any wall funding before because he was feeling so much heat. So you have to assume that the White House and the president are aware of those polls and the potential for that to happen again.
Is this idea of an emergency declaration a potential political out here where the president can say, okay, I signed this garbage deal from Congress, if he follows Sean Hannity's line there, but I'm still fighting for it with this emergency declaration, regardless of whether that ends up doing anything because of court challenges?
Absolutely. And that is what I'm hearing from conservatives who expect the president to do just that. They expect him to sign it, but basically complain the whole way and then say he's, you know, gave some money, can start off construction, and then he'll fight for them to get the rest of the money. And, you know, if it gets caught up in courts, it takes the heat off the president. He still says he's fighting for them. He still says he, you know, declared a national emergency. But I'm not really sure, you know, there are some people in the president's base who will forgive him for anything. And then there are people like Ann Coulter, who this is a huge issue for them. And they've said that the president is caving. So we'd have to see how the full base would react if he were to go that route.
In our last minute, this is a deal reached by Republican and Democratic negotiators from each chamber. Do we have any idea of a timeline on a vote to get this thing done before a shutdown would start this weekend?
We don't at this moment because there's still not text, but they would have to vote on this by Friday. It would have to be signed by the president because at 12:01 a.m. on Saturday, the part of the government would shut down if this was not signed. So they can move pretty quickly if there's consent here, but if there is not, they, you know, this process could take days. And I imagine this is not going to go as smoothly as the bill to reopen the government because there's likely to be opposition on both sides. Though there it is expected there's probably enough votes, bipartisan votes, to move the bill through the House and Senate, it will probably face opposition. So it wouldn't be sort of a unanimous consent, which means they can just move it through on a voice vote.
Eliza, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Eliza Collins, congressional reporter for USA Today. She joined us to talk about the latest on a tentative deal reached in Congress last night. that may avert a government shutdown. Let us know what you think. Do you want Congress to pass this? Do you want the president to sign it? Should the president use emergency powers to find funding for the border wall? Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Last week, we talked about the frost quakes that people were hearing. That happens when the ground gets saturated, then freezes quickly, creating a lot of booming sounds along the way. Some of us here at WPR heard them last week, and some of you did, too. We got emails. Michelle writes, I live in Cross Plains, and all night we were hearing loud banging noises that I believe now can be explained as frost quakes. We thought that things were hitting our house. It was very windy that night, but we didn't see that it could be anything else. Amanda tells us, I'm driving listening to your station right now. I heard those frost quakes all night long. I didn't know what was going on. First, I thought it was a gun where I live in the country. Then after so many, all night long, I thought it was ice coming off the roof and all sorts of different things. I didn't sleep all night. It was literally every 15 to 30 minutes at my house. And Gary writes, I didn't hear a frost quake here, but I live on an inland lake, and we regularly get loud, strange-sounding noises that move when the temp drops and the ice on the lake shrinks, and then cracks with a loud bang that runs across the lake as the crack moves. It gives an eerie kind of sound. Well, we were hearing eerie scraping sounds this morning in much of Wisconsin, plows and shoveling, too. Hopefully my kids off of school have everything dug out for us at home today. If you heard frost quakes or got them on tape, we'd love to hear that. Email that to us, ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.